All right, hello everyone. Welcome back to the Push Podcast.
Hi everybody, welcome back.
My name's Sydney. I'm a labor and delivery nurse.
And I'm Megan. I'm an OBGYN clinical researcher.
And today we are doing our first virtual episode. So Megan and I are in different areas. We are in different areas of the world completely. So bear with us, but we are trying here. We think we figured it out pretty well. So we're getting there.
We're working out the kinks. It is really strange not being in the same room as you, though, Sydney, as we're filming this today. I miss you.
I know. I really, really, really wish we were in the same room and that I got to give Sammy some cuddles this morning. But
Sammy misses his auntie Sid.
yeah. But I'm coming back in a couple weeks, so I will see. I will be in person with you shortly. But for now, we're going to do a little virtual episode. And today we're going to be talking about cosmetic gynecology, which I understand is a topic that is very close to your heart and something that you are pretty passionate about, which makes me excited to pick your brain about all the different types of cosmetic gynecology and what that really means.
Yeah, absolutely. Same.
So today we're going to go over, you know, what we actually mean by cosmetic gynecology. What does that entail? Why it's popular? So there's all kinds of stuff I'm sure people have seen online that we'll get into. And then we'll break down some myths and misconceptions. And then Megan will highlight surgical cosmetic gynecology. So stuff like labiaplasties. And then we'll dive into a little bit more of like other methods of cosmetic gynae, like lasers and vajayshals and all that kind of stuff.
all that funny stuff. Adjacent techniques.
Exactly. So we'll be going over all of that today, and I'm so excited.
Me too. You know, I have always found, or I guess as soon as I started reading a little bit more about cosmetic gynecology in my residency originally, I found it to be a really interesting area of gynecology in that there's obviously a big social factor and social influence with respect to the reasons why people might seek out some of these procedures, right? There's kind of a sociologic component with respect to like, how do we conceive of our genital areas, right? What impacts our genital self-perception? And how does that impact things like sex and wellness and relationships, right?
Yeah.
And then there's also the surgical and the medical component, right? How are we actually studying how people feel about their genitals, how people experience sex, and how the surgical procedures that some people offer and others don't impact those things, both in the short term and the long run? And as a bit of a spoiler alert, it's something part of what stimulated my interest in this area is that it's often felt like there's a big gap in evidence and in the way that we talk about this. It's a complex issue, and it's one that I think a lot of different professional bodies have kind of wanted to take their hands off of. But that's often what kind of picks my brain to say, well, we should look at this, right? Like, we should actually research this if we're not sure what the long-term outcomes are, for instance.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like we've talked about in other episodes, women's health in general usually gets pushed to the side because of that, right? So that's, and this is the same thing, right? So it falls into that same category. So yeah. I'm glad you are willing to do the research for everyone.
Totally. So before we get too into, I think, some of the details of this, I should probably disclose at the top of the episode that I am a provider of some aesthetic gynecology procedures, some limited procedures that I feel have good evidence and good support behind them, and limited evidence for harm, certainly. So things like labiaplasty that I perform predominantly through my husband's office. As some of our like more long-term listeners may know, my husband is a plastic surgeon, and so obviously that's offered me some proximity to that world. Yeah. But I think a lot of people assume that I got into this because I'm married to a plastic surgeon. And that actually isn't the case at all.
Interesting. I actually didn't know that. I did know that a little bit, but like I thought, you know, like everyone else, I thought, yeah, this makes sense. So totally. Tell us how you got into it then.
It actually had nothing to do with Steve at all. back when we were both residents and like fairly junior to mid-level residents at the time, we were, you know, again, residents during the pandemic in Toronto. Yeah. And so everything kind of shut down at that time. The rotation that I was on at the time, we weren't operating, right? Because any elective surgeries were canceled and the ORs were mostly for shut sure. down and only for emergency procedures in the early days of the pandemic in 2020. And so the fellow on the rotation that I was on at the time was great and super gung-ho about continuing our learning. And so she assigned myself and my two colleagues on the rotation topics every single week that we had to look up and we had to teach each other about. So we had to read the guidelines, we had to go down the rabbit hole of the evidence, and then we had to present kind of a 30-minute presentation to each other, I think two or three times a week, to make sure that we were continuing to learn. And I got randomly assigned labiaplasty.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah,
just out of nowhere.
And that's where it came from.
Okay. Yeah, so I thought that I knew how I felt about it at the time. When I got the topic, I'd always found it fairly distasteful to think that we should be trying to create a sense of a perfect vulva or vagina, right? Yep. I found that, like, that idea a little bit off-putting as a woman myself. And so I thought I knew how I felt about it. And then I started actually looking into the evidence. And at the time, I found that some of this, the guidelines and resources I was reading that were quoting things like very high rates of body dysmorphia or high rates of complications with respect to labiaplasty, when I actually looked at the studies that they were citing, sometimes they weren't even, the findings from that study weren't even what our resources were suggesting, right? So I found that they're actually... Okay. didn't seem to be that high of an associated rate with body dysmorphia. And it sort of neglected the, or assumed as well, that colleagues in plastic surgery or aesthetic surgery aren't screening for those kinds of things and mindful with respect to, you know, the motivations that people undertake with respect to aesthetic surgery in general. And so I was kind of disillusioned with my own field. And I felt like if there was so much of a call out to say, you know, we need more research, we need more evidence to know whether or not these things are safe, whether they're effective. I kind of felt like, well, as gynecologists, shouldn't we be involved? Like, this is our area of the body. No one knows the anatomy here better than we do. And we take care of women in the long run, right? Shouldn't we be involved? I don't think that we should be washing our hands of this. And that's for sure not to say that all of my colleagues are anything like to that effect. But that was kind of what, like, almost radicalized me in the other direction. Again, I was increasingly reading that, you know, a lot of women were very, you know, confident in their requests for this. They were confident in their, you know, assessment of their body and that this was something that they felt would improve their experience of it. And the rates of satisfaction were very high and the rates of complication were very low. And so I kind of started thinking, oh, maybe we should learn more about this. Maybe we should talk about this a little bit more openly, especially as gynecologists.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. I love hearing that background, and it's so true. Everything you said is so true. Incorporating someone who, like you, who is a gynecologist who deals with, you know, the reproductive organs and all that kind of stuff, like, it's super important for you to be involved in that care and for, you know, those cares to overlap, whether or not it's cosmetic or not, right? So, yeah.
For sure. And possibly to my detriment, sometimes through my training and career, whenever I've seen kind of like a gap in knowledge, I have a hard time letting go of it. My brain immediately goes to, well, we should try to fill it. We should try to figure out what the answers are there. And so that, again, it was kind of a motivating factor for me.
That's what makes you such a good researcher, such a good doctor. That's why I'm so happy that you are the co-host of the Push podcast, because we need more people like you.
We do. Well, listen, let's get into it, right? I have a lot to say about this topic, both from the perspective of, like, evidence and also from the perspective of, again, like, the, like, social motivators. How do we even begin to navigate such a complicated topic? But before we get into kind of the you know, higher level conversations about, like, why should we want that? Why do people want this? What should we do with that kind of information? What are we even talking about here, right? When we say cosmetic, like, gynecology.
And some people might not even know what a labiaplasty is. So, like, let's break it down a little bit to, like, layman's terms and talk about exactly what we mean by cosmetic gynecology.
Yeah, absolutely. So first and foremost, we have kind of a category that most doctors think of a lot, I think, at least most surgeons would consider when we think about like cosmetic gynecology, which is mm-hmm. surgical procedures, right? We're kind of starting at the like most invasive of the things that you might be offered or might see information about. So labiaplasty being one of the most common procedures, I would say, is basically a surgery that changes the size or shape of usually the labia minora. So kind of what we would consider like the inner lips of the vulva, right? Mm-hmm. It most often involves shortening or reshaping the inner lips, especially if somebody finds them uncomfortable, if they have what we call labial hypertrophy or elongated inner labia. But also sometimes people seek this out because from a more aesthetic perspective, they just don't find they like the look of the inner labia. Labiaplasty can also reference labia majora reconstruction, which would be the outer lips of the vulva. There also are procedures like vaginoplasties, which is a little bit more sometimes of a push and pull, I think, between different surgical specialties. Vaginoplasty, broadly speaking, refers to a procedure that tightens the vaginal canal by bringing stretched tissues and muscles closer together. So this is the one that you often see with respect to like the surgical approach to what people call vaginal rejuvenation, especially after like childbirth or associated with aging. Now, I take issue with the idea of vaginal rejuvenation as a concept in and of itself. And I know that there's plenty of room for people to feel differently. So don't feel, you know, if you're somebody who relates to that term, don't feel like you have to take my side on that or agree with me on that. But I guess as a provider, as somebody who takes care of vulvas and vaginas and uteruses and pelvic organs, I kind of feel like they're, you know, we should respect them at every age and stage that they are. And your vagina, your vulva is not necessarily in need of rejuvenation, right? We should call the issues what they are. There are also some kind of more niche procedures, things like a clitoral hood reduction. So the clitoris obviously is the main sensory kind of component within the vulva itself. And there's a hood or kind of like a layer of tissue that overlies the clitoris. Sometimes that's performed alongside a labiaplasty. Other times it's the predominant procedure. And then the other thing that I think we see kind of more frequently in debates and discussion is a procedure called a hymenoplasty, which I think I've been kind of, you know, seeing more rumbling about, which is basically a surgery that reconstructs the hymen, which is the thin membrane or thin kind of ring near the vaginal opening. It's usually performed for cultural, sometimes religious or sometimes social reasons. But definitely that is an area that is really fraught with, I think, very valid ethical concerns and professional concerns, because it really touches on the concept of, you know, virginity and potentially harmful myths surrounding like the importance or lack thereof of the hymen with respect to like sexual purity, as it were. Then we also have some non-surgical procedures that oftentimes people may be referencing. And this can include things like energy-based devices like lasers or radiofrequency, which are often also kind of marketed in this concept of like vaginal rejuvenation or bringing like youth or elasticity or, you know, in some more benign advertising, like function back to the vagina to what it may have been in your experience previously. And then finally, there's a lot of like non-medical wellness as well, right? Things like vagacials, which you referenced previously. Vaginal steaming, vaginal scrubs, rejuvenation creams. I think this is kind of like an area in the wellness world that has been increasingly kind of tiptoed into over the years. And that also kind of falls for us, I think, within the realm of what we would consider to be cosmetic or aesthetic gynecology.
Yeah, and from what I've heard from most people, is not really recommended by gynecologists. So we're going to get into that. Yeah, because, I mean, I've always heard, like, nothing up there. Nothing. You don't need to do anything to your vulva, and you don't need to do anything to your vagina.
Have you heard the analogy that the vagina is a self-cleaning oven?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I love that.
Yeah, Yeah, yeah.
She is the best to just leave her alone and let her do her own
leave
thing.
Leave her alone. The best vulvar care is no creams, no soaps, nothing, certainly, you know, nothing not prescribed by your physician for like specific medical concerns.
Just give water.
Give her some air, right?
Air her out, yeah. I remember actually being in university and even like social media, and I know it's the same nowadays, but this was even years ago. Mm-hmm. People were all about the vaginal like cleansers, like to make sure your vagina smelt and like tasted good. Like that was like everywhere. It was like make sure it smells like flowers and like I don't know. I remember everyone buying these like soaps and products and stuff, and it's just now that I know more about the woman's body and the vulva and the vagina in general, like, and that it is a self-cleaning oven, like, I cannot believe how viral that went and how many people just put so many different products there. Like, it's just, I don't know, it's mind-blowing to me, and it's so not good.
Oh, totally, Sydney. And I remember kind of in my, like, late teens or early 20s, like, whenever it was when I kind of became aware of that. And like suddenly I feel like a lot of young women actually have like a moment that they can recall where they became like aware of like idealized anatomy, right? So like your labia is supposed to look like this, or your vulva and vagina is supposed to smell like this, or it's supposed to taste like this. Exactly as you said, you're supposed to put this in it. And we all have this moment, I think, that we can recall where we're like, whoa.
Yes.
Whoa. Wait, what? Yes. Like something about my anatomy is not normal. And I think this information can arrive too at such a vulnerable time in people's, you know, self-awareness and sexual development too, right?
Yes.
It's such a time when you're so, you're discovering who you are in so many ways, and you're so, you know, susceptible, I think, to information that may tell you that you need feel anxious or insecure about a body part that you maybe never considered before, right?
Yes. It's interesting because now, years later, working as a labor and delivery nurse, I cannot believe that that's what was fed to me, because
I know
being a labor and delivery nurse, you see, and a gynecologist, like you, like you just see everything. You see every different type of vagina, every different, like,
truly, no, there is no ideal vulva. There is no normal, like there is such a range of normal.
There's such a range of normal, and at the same time, at the end of the day, they are all similar in their own way. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, it's just, it's something that I don't think the average population can relate to, of like being able to have seen so many vaginas. But like, truly, guys, like they're all unique, and they're all perfect in their own way. And like, whatever feels right to you, and whatever you want to do to your to your vulva is totally your prerogative and what you want to do, but we're here to just talk about what's safe and what's not safe and what's recommended and what's not recommended. But at the end of the day, like, she's gorgeous just the way she is.
You know, I've had a lot of patients ask me over the years, and like very like sweet, well-meaning patients, right, ask me things like, oh, like, how do you handle like being around vulvas and vaginas all day? Like, don't you find that gross? Or people, as we, I think, have alluded to in, you know, our episode about things not to be embarrassed about at the gynecologist, people apologize a lot for the like look or smell or, you know,
all the time,
like discharge, whatever associated with their vulvas. And the amount of times I have told people, like, the average vulva is far from what I consider to be the grossest part of the body. Like, there are so many grosser things about our bodies than vulvas. Vulvas are fine. Like, they're deeply fine.
Yeah.
So no, fine.
I 100% agree. Like, and I would argue that every single person I've worked with feels the exact same way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. They're honestly so fine. Mouths, on the other hand, disgust me. I couldn't be a dentist.
I know. Yeah, I could not be a dentist either. Teeth, no thank you. We all have our thing. We all have our thing, and we would not have gone into obstetrics and gynecology if the vulva was something that gave us the ick. And like, at the end of the day, it's It really doesn't. And it shouldn't give anyone the ick. I'm just going to put that out there. But but we will for sure not judge you for anything. Okay. We have seen so many, like, so much, guys. We have seen so much. And, like, if you haven't listened to that episode, absolutely go give it a listen, because we talk about everything that you don't need to be embarrassed about. But just wanted to briefly touch on that before we continue with this episode.
Oh, totally, totally. You know, I think it's interesting to kind of examine, too, like, how did this become popular? When did we even start talking about our vulvas as, and our vaginas as, like, something to be commodified, right? Like something, something that we need to buy products for, something that we need to, like, address with surgery. And I think it's probably a, like, super complex question. And the influences, I imagine, are different generationally too, right? And I think you're right to point out, said that, like, as we were growing up, and I, like, very generously lump myself in with you in the we, because I am solidly a millennial and you are Gen Z for sure. But it's fine. I'm young.
That's okay.
And cool,
I have millennial tendencies. It's fine.
But, you know, I do think that, like, these conversations kind of started to seep in as we were coming of age. And I actually remember the first time I, like, or one of the first times I, like, heard in a public forum somebody comment on vulvar appearance. And it was, do you remember, you were probably too young for this, but Dane Cook used to be really popular. He has, used to have, I don't even, I think it was long before Netflix, he had these specials that I think I downloaded on, like, iTunes and put on my little, like, iPod at the time. And I would listen to these comedy specials. And anyway, I remember him referring to the labia minora as meat curtains.
Yeah.
And it scarred me. Like, I was like, wait, wait. Again, what? Like, this is something, like, I, like, suddenly you're like, oh my God, do I have meat curtains? Yeah. What are meat curtains? What constitutes meat curtains? How long or short do they have to be? Like, what is, where does the problem begin and end? And what should I do about this? And I remember feeling, like, so shocked and self-conscious and embarrassed suddenly, again, about something that I had never even, like, wrapped my mind around before. And I feel like that speaks to, like, this is kind of like the early eras of more social media, but I imagine it's kind of become more prevalent over the years. Sydney, what have you seen with respect to, like, how we've started talking about our vulvas on social media?
I honestly think it does start from a very young age. So when when teenagers are being shown online, and this is more nowadays than any day before that, but being shown online all of these kinds of things and treatments and, you know, marketing it as self-care and almost exploitive as well. Like, it's just, and I think it also comes down to, you know, potentially seeing things in pornographic contexts as well. It gives me a little bit at how much is online and how much can be so misleading for young women, right? Who are just discovering their own sexual health and their own, you know, prerogative on their own body and how it looks and how it feels and how it smells and all of that kind of stuff. Yeah. So so there's that aspect, but then there's also a whole other market online with postpartum. So that attacks a whole other demographic of people who, you know, that's where we were talking about the vaginal tightening and rejuvenation after birth and how, you know, your vagina needs to be tightened and changed after you've had a baby.
You know, I think you're totally right. And the things that impact our genital self-image are obviously multidimensional, right? Like, when we've looked at kind of what weighs in on this, things like, as you say, like, the opinions of peers, comments of people in your life certainly weigh heavy. Advertising and media, including social media, right? That, again, raises concerns, like things like odor that previously may not have been something that you considered, or also that, like, may not be medically supported, right? With respect to things like deodorizers, douching, all of that kind of thing. For your vagina, which are, again, not recommended by healthcare providers, because they can, they do not only not, they're not only not necessary, but they also can be a locus for irritation and sometimes even infection, right?
Exactly.
Which is not something that anybody wants to experience. Now, we're lumping a lot of different things, though, into, like, one big box, right? All of these various cosmetic gynecology procedures that we've discussed, we're kind of putting into one thing. And we've even only like mentioned a few things that are out on the market kind of in a more public, in a more noticeable way. And there's, you know, innumerable different products and services that are available these days. But when we look at surgical data, which is certainly what like I'm most familiar with what I think we have most access to, the motivations for seeking at least labiaplasty do tend to fall into kind of some categories that I think people might find a bit unexpected. Number one is aesthetic concerns, right? So about 70% of people in a recent retrospective review, so looking back kind of at data or at a patient set and at their experience, cited aesthetic concerns. So they didn't like the way it looked. Now, hard to say what weighed into that perspective, but that was kind of the main driving force. But I think what's also important for us to reconcile with as we're discussing this, again, in a nuanced patient-centered way, is that functional concerns also made up over 60% of the reasons why somebody would seek out this particular procedure. And again, by functional concerns, that might mean sexual dysfunction, right? It also might mean just discomfort. So with labiaplasty specifically, a lot of people seek it out because they have elongated inner labia and that they find it uncomfortable to like wear yoga pants, ride a bike, do activities that we would consider to be normal. And I think it's important for us as providers to recognize that for labial hypertrophy or large labia, which by the way, doesn't really have a established medical definition for size, right? Yeah. I would kind of define it as like a size in which people experience discomfort. The only non-surgical options available feel like puritanical, like New England recommendations. It's like wear loose cotton garments, right?
Yes.
Don't wear bathing suits. Don't wear spandex, you know, only loose like cotton underwear.
Which is not realistic really for most people. Yeah.
No. So again, there's like a huge functional component that overlies all of this as well. And I think that if we, by ignoring that, we're kind of, you know, invalidating the experience of a lot of people who may have real functional drivers for seeking out procedures that we've kind of called cosmetic, right? As if it is something that is not needed or something that is, you know, a little bit more superficially driven, right? It's interesting you bring up porn too, because what I find really interesting about the whole influence of porn is that it is, has been blamed, I think, kind of universally, right? For people having all sorts of different feelings about their genitalia and also oftentimes like approach to sex, especially as young people, right? Kind of navigating this for the first time. But some studies that have actually looked at whether porn was a motivator for seeking things like labiaplasty or actual surgical procedures found that only about 10% of people cite the influence of pornography when they're considering surgical procedures. Now, and a substantial proportion of them don't endorse watching pornography at all, right? So I think what's really interesting about that is that, well, it's hard to kind of capture how much, even if like porn wasn't the main driving factor, right? Like someone seeing something on porn and saying like, that's what I want for my vulva. It's hard to kind of capture how much of seeing that presented as a norm, for instance, like very small labia, kind of seeped into someone's brain and influenced a decision. I think the other side of that coin too is that perhaps there's a little bit of like puritanical panic about the about, you know, sex and media and pornography being a necessarily bad thing that is influencing the way that we see our bodies. And perhaps again, like our you know, our genital self-conception is a little bit more nuanced and complicated and even influenced by like real world factors more than porn. I think it certainly like leaves that open for debate and raises a question as to like whether porn is the reason for blame for all the things that we have problems with the way that we engage with sex.
Yes, that's a very good point.
So Sydney, I think we have some myths and misconceptions to address in this episode, right?
Yes. The first myth is that all vulvas should look the same. So that Barbie vulva, that Barbie vagina, I'm sure you guys have all heard about. This is definitely a myth. They shouldn't all look the same, but why? Tell me why.
This is absolutely a myth. There is as much vulvar diversity as there is diversity in every other aspect of us. And diversity is healthy and good and normal, right? There is no idealized vulva. There is no perfect genitalia, right? Obviously, if something about your vulva is causing you problems, right? Whether that be severe, you know, anxiety and concerns about appearance, or if it's functional, right? If it's causing you distress, discomfort, pain even, then that's absolutely something to address with a provider. But there is no normal. And I think that starting with normalizing vulvar diversity is always like a great place to start in conversations about like genital satisfaction, right?
Okay, myth number two, rejuvenation guarantees better sex or restored youth.
So definitely no. And don't listen to anybody on the internet or otherwise who tries to sell you a form of rejuvenative procedure as the be all end all. And I say that as somebody, again, who does provide some limited cosmetic gynecology. The reason for that is, first of all, most rejuvenative procedures and tools and products have at best like some modest evidence for them, and at worst no evidence, right? Or even evidence for harm, depending on the procedure itself. But I think the important thing to consider here is not that all of these things are necessarily bad or contraindicated, but rather that sexual function is really complex, right?
Yeah.
It is rarely as simple as like, oh, fix this one structural thing about your vagina and then you're going to have great sex, right? Sex is so complex and there's so many issues at the core of someone's sexual experience. And so I really think that, you know, again, it's not to say that like there isn't a role for some of these procedures and products, but rather that being able to have like a compassionate, comprehensive assessment, I think is really, really essential, right?
Yeah.
Surgical procedures are often largely safe, but again, I think viewing, you know, rejuvenative procedures as the be-all end-all for sexual function, even if we begin to explore this more and find more and more evidence for them, I think, again, sex will always be complex enough to require like a comprehensive approach.
Exactly. And it's important to open that discussion with your provider instead of leaning towards, you know, a rejuvenation or these targeted ads that promise you to have better sex after having a baby or whatever. You know, it's really, we want to drive home that it's really important to just have this conversation with your primary care physician or OBGYN. And trust me, guys, they've heard this before. It's not something to be embarrassed about. It's
totally
something that we are open to talking about. Like you said, sexual health is important and it's universal, right? So it's okay to
talk
about
super important. Having an assessment by somebody who can really assess that, right? Who can say, like, you have prolapse or you have pelvic floor dysfunction or you have endometriosis and that is the root or at least part of the picture of it, as opposed to just always assuming that there is like an easy aesthetic solution. I think that that is really, really important. As a gynae, obviously, I'm biased. I think that we are the experts in the pelvic, in the gynecologic structures. And so we're in a great position to be able to perform these comprehensive assessments.
Myth number three I want to talk about is if celebrities or influencers promote it, it must be safe.
I think anyone, even, I mean, Sid, you're a content creator and you know that there are like, there are lots of promotions that are not necessarily based in evidence, or even I'm sure there have been things that you've been asked to promote that you wouldn't necessarily feel you have the like, that
diet
you believe in.
Pills, or that hair growth supplements, all these kinds of supplement companies, guys. I don't, you will never see me promoting some kind of supplement like that because no matter how much money they give you, but I'm just saying there's people out there who will take the money and will say this absolutely changed my vulva completely and now it's perfect, you know? It's, they'll say anything, right? Money is a driving force.
Ultimately, at the end of the day, everyone's trying to sell you something, right? I think though what's important for patients and for people to consider again is that the wellness industry and the cosmetic industry in Canada alone spans billions of dollars, right? And certainly in the US and globally, this is like a multi-billion dollar industry. And I'll scream this from the rooftops. It doesn't mean that these products are bad, but when we apply very valid, often, critiques of the pharmaceutical industry, which is also a billion-dollar industry, we don't often provide those same critiques for the wellness industry, I think, because it's given a little bit of like some sense of ethical superiority. But really, they're a for-profit industry at the end of the day that is subject to less oversight from institutions like the FDA and Health Canada than things like the pharmaceutical industry or the medical device industry are. Most pharmaceuticals and medical device companies are, in order to receive that kind of regulation, they have to not necessarily only show that things don't cause harm, but they often have to show that it works, right? And most health and wellness products in the private industry do not have to always show that it works in order to receive the ability to bring this product to market. And so I think applying critical thinking, taking things with a grain of salt, and recognizing that even the wellness industry is trying to sell you something is really, really important when we're beginning to navigate, especially vulvar health, right? And which is becoming like this increasingly this cash cow for products.
Absolutely. It's the evidence and the effectiveness before the sales isn't necessarily there. So take it. Just be careful. Just be careful with where you spend your money and what you spend your money on, because most of the time, you know, a conversation with your healthcare provider is more valuable and more beneficial to you than buying a product that your favorite influencer is promoting. So,
and if it seems too good to be true, oftentimes it probably is, right? Because all health issues are multidimensional and nuanced and require like comprehensive care. Most things we do require like multidisciplinary care, right? Most major health issues. And so like with multiple different providers, being able to help out and provide assistance. And so particularly with respect to things like sexual function, chronic pain, all of that kind of thing. And so there rarely is a simple answer to these issues. And certainly it and doesn't usually come in the form of like a cream or a jade egg or any of the other classic, you know, examples of the products marketed for your vagina and your vulva.
Yeah. And listen, this is not, we're not judging you. Like I've been there. I've been influenced and bought things online that I absolutely should not have. You know what I mean? Like,
oh my God,
it's easy to be influenced and to just say add to cart and like, in the middle of the night when you're scrolling. Listen, we've all been there. We've all been there.
Oh my God. Two key points in my life, the pandemic and then immediately postpartum. I've been so susceptible to Instagram ads. The amount of absolute garbage I've ordered online in the middle of the night is, you know, humbling. So
let's go into a little bit more of the surgical side. So I know this is the part you love. This is what you love to do. This is
you. Evidence. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. So evidence on the labiaplasties. Tell me about it.
Long and the short of it is I will say with respect to cosmetic gynecology in general, even the surgical procedures, there's kind of this like push and pull, I think, sometimes between providers who are providing it, whether they be gynecologists or plastic surgeons or some other discipline, urogynecologists, sometimes urologists, and kind of like the gynecologists that have the meat of general pelvic health. And so oftentimes we're caught in this situation where I think many of our guidelines and many of our resources have said previously that there isn't a lot of safety evidence for all sorts of different gynecologic procedures, right? So labiaplasty, posterior repairs, vaginoplasty, all of those kinds of things. And we don't have a lot of data to guide us as to how having one of those procedures done when you're like 25 or 30 impacts you in the long run. Like, how does it impact childbirth? How does it change in menopause? Is there an impact? And so again, like, I come to this, number one, being very honest with you guys that they're like, we still don't have a lot of good evidence for these things. But I think there's kind of one main evidence point here that I would like to raise is that in reviewing a lot of this evidence, while certainly a lot of the like the questions that we have as a discipline, I think are very valid. I think necessarily also studies that look at patient satisfaction typically comprise what we would call lower quality evidence, right? Because by nature, patient satisfaction is something that can be subjective, right? It's your experience of a different disorder, or like in a broad sense, right? Or of a procedure that you undertake. And that is, you know, subject to all sorts of different things, right? If it's something that you've paid for, then there is a documented like increase in your likelihood to say that it worked, right?
Yeah.
But by the same token,
absolutely,
saying that there is no evidence for a procedure that is aesthetic in consideration, right? Like if the problem that we're trying to solve is that somebody is dissatisfied with the appearance of something, and then they say afterwards that they are now satisfied with the appearance of something and their experience of it, well, then that is also important, right? It may not meet the standards of evidence as we have kind of laid it out in clinical medicine, because we have this like established hierarchy of what constitutes good evidence and what doesn't, right? But I think it's nonetheless a little bit paternalistic of us to say, well, there's no evidence for something, right? If, again, it's treating a purely experiential issue and patients are telling us that their experience has been good, right?
Yeah.
So let's get into it with respect to labiaplasty. Overwhelmingly, there is actually pretty good evidence to say that people feel happy having had a labiaplasty previously, and that specifically when the main concerns were either aesthetic, so concerns with the appearance of the labia, or functional, so things like, again, the pain that we talked about with respect to like larger labia. Full disclosure, guys, I have actually done a study on the long-term outcomes of labiaplasty. It was a review study where we were pulling from a bunch of different, any study that met the criteria that basically looked at labiaplasty and long-term outcomes, and we pulled that data. It is not the best quality study, I will say. We're proud of it, but it's not the best quality because we don't have a lot of data to pull from, right? And so a lot of the statistics that we've done are not like complex statistics. They're not ones that we can really hang our hats on, but they do provide us, I think, direction for future research and also to kind of get a sense of what's going on with things.
It's a start. It's
totally a start. So overwhelmingly in our study, which I believe is the only study that collated like long-term outcomes for labiaplasty, the vast majority of patients reported no postoperative complications at long-term follow-up. And long-term follow-up was defined as greater than 1 year. The most commonly reported complications were things like continued asymmetry of the labia or redundancy. So perhaps not enough was reduced. That is about 6% of patients. About 5% of patients did need some form of revisional surgery. Now, again, not enough data to say whether these were like major revisional surgeries or very like minor revisions.
Yeah.
And then finally, about 1.8% of people did report scarring or a jagged appearance or too much having been taken off as a concern post-operatively. The less common complications, and I think this should be reassuring from the perspective of providers, not even that are, you know, recommending this or doing this themselves, but at least if we're seeing patients who are having this done or who are requesting this procedure, is that the things that we worry about, right? Like things like worse sexual function, things like nerve pain at the site of the surgical site, the areas where we resected the labia, things like changes to someone's sensation, right? Or changes to their ability to like urinate, right? Because we're operating kind of in and around all those structures, are all very low. So all of those risks are far less than 1%, which again, is not reason to have this done if you weren't already thinking of having it. But I do think if we're seeing people who are requesting this, people who have sometimes very valid reasons to want to have this done, this should at least be reassuring that the rates of complications that I would classify at least as more significant are pretty small, which is ultimately a good thing. Now, problems with kind of hanging our hats again on some of this data, and this will be uniform throughout our discussion of the actual evidence for some of these procedures, is that we don't have good, first of all, definitions, right, of like what the different surgical approaches to something like this are. What is labial hypertrophy? How much should be taken off? How should you make your incision? How should you close your incision? What is long-term follow-up? And how do we actually ask questions to patients who are experiencing this? And so because of it, we again get a really high rate of heterogeneity within these studies and within these literature reviews, right? And what that means, again, is that when the studies are done so differently, when they all kind of make their definitions a little bit differently, it becomes very hard to pool that data to find like really conclusive evidence for even things like safety. So plenty of room, I think, in this field for further research, especially because this is something that people are asking for in increased numbers.
Now, if for any of our listeners who are thinking to themselves now, like, oh, well, I've always kind of wanted a labiaplasty and I didn't know how to go about it, I think they're also probably thinking like who to bring it up to and then costs associated with it. Do you have any information on that you can share?
Yeah. I mean, listen, I would always say bring it up to a trusted provider. That may be a... if this is somebody who's, you know, interfaced with plastic surgery before or cosmetic facilities before, then that may be that. It could be your family doctor, right? I would hope that it would be your gynecologist and your OBGYN. Okay. But I think asking a provider about at least like things you should be concerned about, asking for an assessment with somebody who's trained to provide that assessment, I think is really helpful. As far as cost, the cost varies, right? There are some centers in some places, I'm sure, where some of these functional concerns may be covered by things like insurance. I can't speak to like, you know, all countries, all places.
Everywhere in the world, yeah.
Exactly, exactly. Especially for the functional concerns, right? When we're talking about like not to minimize someone's concern about the appearance of their labia, right? But like some people are seeking this because they have like pain or discomfort, right? And so it's possible that that is covered in some cases. I would hope that it would be, right?
Yeah.
Other places, this all kind of falls into the private surgery world, which is unfortunate in my opinion, because certainly I think like the people who are experiencing discomfort should probably be getting more support than that.
Okay. Now, as far as the evidence in terms of energy-based devices, so lasers, radio frequency, you know, for tightening, dryness, all that kind of stuff. Can we dive into that now?
Yeah, absolutely. So some of the non-surgical vaginal tightening tools and techniques that are available, again, include things like fractional microablative CO2, erbium lasers, temperature controlled radio frequency devices, things like that, which are a whole bunch of like big words. And we're going to kind of cut into what they all essentially do, right? Okay. They're usually recommended recommended, it's the wrong word, but they're usually marketed towards people who may be experiencing things like vaginal laxity or looseness, genitourinary syndrome of menopause, so people who are experiencing like vaginal dryness or discomfort of the vulva and vagina secondary to menopause, and vulvovaginal atrophy. And the mechanism of action, again, is largely kind of the same. So for lasers, basically, these devices are delivering like heat and thermal energy to the mucosa of the vagina, to kind of like the skin of the vagina.
Yeah.
And what that is supposed to do is to basically cause damage that then initiates remodeling of the tissue, right? So radio frequency devices kind of similarly create heat in the submucosal tissue, so in those tissues themselves. And that promotes denaturation or kind of breakdown of the collagen within those tissues. And then subsequently, like when you break down that collagen, your body says, oh shit, we've got to bring more collagen in. We've got to make more. And again, it's the same kind of thought where like we're damaging the tissue so that we poke our body into repairing it, hopefully in a way that is, you know, a little bit better than before, right? And theoretically, these things, like this is not a stupid idea, right? And we know that there's lasers that we use in this way in all sorts of other areas of medicine. And so the theory, I think, is sound with respect to how they may work. Now, when we look at employing these in a study, what actually happens? There are some observational studies which have looked at things like the lasers, especially for vaginal tightness and sexual function, that have found rates of high patient satisfaction and minor adverse events. However, when we do these big studies that we've talked about, so these like systematic reviews and meta-analyses where we're like grabbing not just one study, but all the studies we can find that look at this in the way that we're trying to assess, and we pool all that data, What we find basically is that these devices at this point are not shown to consistently demonstrate significant improvements, at least in either vaginal laxity or sexual function, compared to what we call sham controls. So basically, compared to doing nothing and having someone not know whether they received, a laser or not, for instance. So right now, kind of where we sit is that the certainty of evidence is moderate for things like sexual function, low for pelvic muscle, floor strength, and things like that. And a lot of the studies have a significant risk of bias associated with them.
Okay.
We don't, again, as with many things in this area, have a lot of long-term safety data, which certainly should be considered with respect to anybody who's looking to undertake one of these devices. And then the other thing is that there usually is a pretty high cost associated with it, as with most things that fall kind of outside of the realm of like either public medicine in Canada or like insurance provided medicine in other places. And so overall, what I would say to somebody who's considering something like this is that, number one, like I will die on this hill that anybody with like sexual function issues or pain or discomfort at the vulva or vagina, please see a gynecologist just to at least make sure that there isn't like a publicly funded solution, right? Or or a solution that has nothing to do with what somebody in like in a like med spa might tell you is the problem, right? Like see yes. somebody who can really assess your gynecologic organs, your pelvic floor, to begin to weed out like what could be wrong, because there's innumerable things that can cause these same constellation of symptoms, right? But at the end of the day, if this does kind of fall into like, if you do kind of fall into the population of patients who potentially could benefit from this, make sure that you're seeing like licensed providers in a safe setting with good medical oversight. And then, you know, if cost is an issue, then certainly weighing, I think the likelihood of it working is something important to consider, right? If cost is not an issue and you're happy to try anything, then like go for it, as long as it is safe and you're with, you know, under the supervision of a good care team, and we're not missing other problems because we're assuming it has to do with like vaginal laxity, right? But if cost is an issue, this is something to consider with respect to, you know, what to do about it.
In terms of like vaginal steaming and, you know, the vulva masks, like I've seen these sheet masks. I had a company reach out to me a couple of times.
Really?
For me to promote. Yeah, this was about a year ago.
But overwhelmingly, these things are not supported in medical literature. And I think there is substantial risk and concern for harm associated with many of them. Vagational is not like a term in medical literature, right? Like there's not like an established thing.
It's not a
although
thing.
I'm sure it's offered in lots of spas and healthcare facilities. Same with like vaginal tightening creams and things like that. Any of these like products that we're putting kind of in and around the vagina, all will largely lack efficacy and safety data, right? And we do think that outside of like well-described vaginal creams and products, so things like vaginal estrogen, right, which is very safe for use overwhelmingly and used to good efficacy, especially in the context of like low estrogen states like menopause, to treat, you know, thinness of the vaginal tissues and discomfort associated with it. A lot of the things you'll find commercially available are not well studied and, again, potentially harmful. We don't usually want to be putting products in and around our vulva, unless it's specifically treating certain disorders and things that are well established in the literature. Vaginal steaming is not just unsupported, but also has been associated with documented harm, specifically from thermal injury, right? So there have been reports of second degree burns resulting from vaginal steaming. And there certainly is no evidence for benefit with respect to things like vaginal tightness, and definitely not like prolapse reduction. I hate to say it, guys, I know we all want like a magic pill or cream that's going to fix all our problems. And I get and appreciate in some ways the fact that like some of these kind of spa procedures are getting us at least like talking about our vulvas in a little bit more of a socially acceptable, like open way, right? But the vulva overwhelmingly is a simple organ, and she likes to be clean and dry, and she doesn't like a lot of products. And so that is kind of the mainstay of what we would call vulvar hygiene usually.
Okay. Well, is there any other take-home messages you want our listeners to know before we sign off for the day?
There's so much nuance in this topic, right? Mm-hmm. It's true that I think there's lots of elements of social media and advertising that glamorize things like cosmetic gynecology. But I do think that patients deserve transparent. And again, like a lot of these products and services are not necessarily, some are harmful, some are like not evidence-based, but some are safe, right? And some have good quality evidence behind them, at least as far as achieving things like patient satisfaction. And I think what we really should be striving for as a discipline is not to change people's minds necessarily about their bodies, right?
Yeah.
But rather to provide like transparency about risks and costs. Yep. And also about the fact that sometimes treatments may not be medically necessary, right? Normalizing anatomy, making sure people at least feel supported in that aspect of it. And I think that as well, you know, a lot of providers, we should be mindful of what could be conceived as like being dismissive of people's concerns, right? Especially if we do all the normalization, if we show a million vulvas and somebody still doesn't feel satisfied with theirs, right? Like that is also valid, right? And I think we all need to stay engaged in this space and continuing to do research to make sure that we can provide patients with the best possible evidence and the best possible outcomes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, tell us, guys, let us know if you've seen ads for these kinds of things online, if you've tried any of them, what your experience has been, if you feel comfortable sharing. Like, we want to know, because this is why we built this community. So comment down below. Make sure you follow us on social media. So we're on TikTok and Instagram at the.push.podcast. And we release a new episode every Wednesday. So wherever you listen to your podcast, you can also watch us on YouTube. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. I hope you found it helpful and that it gave you some good tips and things to think about moving forward with your own vulvar health and self-image in that respect.
Let us know what you think. We can't wait to chat with you guys about this more.